awfully lucky that the wind was going the other way. If it had been in some other direction, we would have had a drastic situation.
Firefighters gain partial control of a blaze near Fairbanks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 23rd of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, looking back on the long life of Walter Soboloff.
He happened to be Tlingit, but he really always spoke to the whole world.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
Substantial progress has been made on corralling a Fairbanks area wildfire. The Moose Mountain Fire has burned more than 940 acres in an area just northwest of the city since Friday. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The season's first big wildfire hit very close to home for some Fairbanks area residents who live near the Moose Mountain ski area, but the response from firefighters was intense. The wind-fueled blaze was hit hard with aerial retardant and water drops from planes and helicopters to keep it away from residential areas. Friday's heat and wind gave way to cooler, wetter, calmer weather on Saturday and Sunday, allowing firefighters to work the perimeter on the ground. Incident Commander Rob Allen told area residents at a public meeting Sunday night, things are looking a lot better.
The fire itself, other than burning out a few little interior pockets, which you might have seen some smoke coming up today, has been really laying low.
Allen says about 300 people are working the Moose Mountain Fire. He says bulldozers have plowed around much of the perimeter and that hand crews are doing the job on 3 miles of steeper terrain. The fire is about 60% contained, but Allen says there's a lot of work to be done.
Trying to get 10 to 20 feet totally secured all the way around the fire, and that's when we'll call it controlled. After we have 20 feet, then we'll go in 100, then we'll go in 200, until we're comfortable with the fact that we've got enough mopped up, 100%. And when we say 100% mopped up, crews will go through this, and they'll hand feel every inch along that edge. They'll wander around, picking up all the logs, checking all the stuff, doing it all by hand. That's how we call it out.
Allen anticipates containment by Wednesday, but is not speculating on an out date. He says the early season fire has not burned very deep because much of the area has only been snow-free for less than 10 days. State Fire Information Officer Pete Buist says there's still no determination on what started the fire.
Fires can be human-caused or they can be caused by lightning. There was no lightning. So we're left with the millions of ways that people can start fires. Now we have to sort through all those different types of human-caused and figure out what it was. But bottom line is the idea is to get line around it now, and the cause is not as important as that.
The fire has raised questions about the ability to notify residents in the event of an evacuation order using the borough's reverse 911 call-out system. Borough Emergency Services Director Dave Gibbs cautioned residents at Sunday's fire meeting that the system only works with landlines.
A lot of you rely upon cell phones, and there is no technology that I'm aware of that will automatically locate you and provide you with messaging, so I need to get your cell phone numbers.
Gibbs says the borough is collecting cell numbers from area residents, even though an evacuation is highly unlikely at this point. Borough Mayor Luke Hopkins said things could have been a lot worse.
We're awfully lucky that the wind was going the other way. If it had been in some other direction to the south, we would have had one heck of a few hours and a drastic situation.
Hopkins says the Moose Mountain Fire has underscored the importance of carrying out the community's wildfire protection plan. The borough and state have been working since the record fire summer of 2004 to clear breaks across corridors of black spruce that can carry wildfires into Fairbanks. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
People in the Northwest Alaska community of Kobuk are cleaning up after high water flooded village streets with ice over the weekend. The water started rising on Friday. By Saturday morning, residents of one home, including children and an elder of 94, were evacuated by boat to the village clinic. They reported their house was shaking as large chunks of ice crashed into it. Residents say this is the worst flooding Kobuk has experienced in many years. The river rose 5 feet above flood level, and people were paddling and motoring their boats through the streets and between houses. Some people reported that the water level was only a foot or so below floor level. Water was down by Sunday, but it left lots of ice around town, with some roads not passable because of the ice. Kobuk residents are used to the threat of flooding and prepare for the possibility every year. There were no injuries, but there will be a lot of cleaning up to do. The village of Buckland escaped flood damage this year after several days of flood warnings last week. Roads were underwater as ice jams above and below the village raised water levels and threatened to flood homes. But the ice came through without spilling over and damaging homes along the riverbank. Five Anchorage residents are safe after their pleasure boat, the Nordic Mistress, sank yesterday, 85 miles north of Kodiak. The boat's operator called in a mayday to the Coast Guard just before noon yesterday, saying their 60-foot vessel was taking on water. Four men and a teenager were on board. Petty Officer Jonathan Lally says a helicopter was dispatched from Kodiak to search for the boat.
The rescue crew arrived on scene at 12:35 p.m., finding the vessel partially submerged and all five survivors in survival suits and in a life raft surrounded by debris in the water.
The survivors were lifted into the helicopter and flown back to Kodiak. It isn't known how much fuel was on board the Nordic Mistress, but no pollution from the incident has been reported. At the time of the rescue, the winds were about 15 miles per hour with 6-foot seas. The Coast Guard office in Anchorage is investigating the sinking, but no cause has been determined yet. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Soldotna residents learned the key to a successful cattle drive.
Ride like you got an egg in the back of your pocket. That's pretty much what it is. The slower they go, the better off it is.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
AT&T, rethink possible. Details at att.com/Alaska or 1-800-252-7266.
An increasing number of dead birds have been showing up in downtown Kodiak. The die-off is attracting the interest of federal officials who were initially concerned the birds were dying from an avian disease. Robin Corcoran is the bird biologist for the Kodiak National Wildlife Refuge. She says it's a bit of a mystery, but someone may be poisoning or shooting the birds. She says there's another possible explanation, too.
For me, when I see corvids, which are the crows and the ravens and the jays and the magpies, when I see them, I'm concerned in sort of a mass die-off situation, which is more than, say, two. They are very prone to West Nile, which I don't think we have West Nile disease in the state, but for that species group, when I see a mass die-off, that's the first thing I think. So I need to collect the carcasses, and if I continue to see them, I will need to send them to Madison, Wisconsin, where we have a research lab that will test them for that.
The majority of the dead birds are pigeons, which are not indigenous, but Corcoran has collected crows and a seagull as well.
The Gaugus wingull was wounded. It had blood on it. The other birds were, the carcasses were older. In fact, I think two of them were just basically sets of wings. They had been scavenged, so there's no way to really know what they died of.
Corcoran is concerned that if some of the birds are being poisoned, eagles, which are protected under federal law, could become poisoned too. Corcoran says if the bird deaths expand to migratory or protected species, they could span local, state, and federal jurisdictions.
To be honest with you, I don't know who has jurisdiction, who is supposed to be investigating this kind of an incident. We're hoping to interest law enforcement in it so that we can get to the bottom of it. It's Oscar's dock, so it's sort of high profile, and especially with the cruise ships coming in now and with Crab Fest, we hope that if someone is doing something down there that's killing birds, that it'll stop. I guess we need for it to stop.
Corcoran says there are two hunting seasons for crows, but not in the summertime. Pigeons are fair game year-round, and there is no bag limit. The Reverend Dr. Walter Soboloff has died at the age of 102. He passed away Sunday morning at his home in Juneau. He was the first Alaska Native pastor in Juneau during segregation, but his church was open to all. While Walter Soboloff has often been called the spiritual and cultural standard bearer of the Tlingit people, his influence went well beyond. Ross Soboloff is his youngest son.
He spoke to the whole world. He happened to be Tlingit, but he really always spoke to the whole world, as selflessly as you can do that.
He is survived by 4 children and several grandchildren. Services are pending. On his 102nd birthday last November, Soboloff reflected on his life with KTOO's Rosemarie Alexander.
In his more than a century of life, the Reverend Dr. Walter Soboloff saw 2 world wars and numerous other military conflicts. As a boy, he watched young Tlingit men leave their families to go off to World War I. As a pastor, he nurtured parents whose sons were fighting in other wars. And now it's the war on terrorism.
And I wish that the fathers and mothers would rise up in the world and say, no more wars, we lose our children.
Walter Soboloff was born November 14, 1908 in Killisnoo, a Tlingit Russian community on Admiralty Island that no longer exists. The family moved to Tanaki, and when his father passed away, he was sent to the Russian Orthodox Bishop School in Sitka, then went on to Sheldon Jackson, the Presbyterian Mission School. It was there that he first heard Christian sermons in English and became a Presbyterian. Years later, on a full scholarship to the University of Dubuque in Iowa, he earned a bachelor's in education and graduate degree in divinity. In 1940, he was ordained and became pastor at Memorial Presbyterian in Juneau, a church created by the National Presbyterian denomination to serve a Tlingit congregation.
And early I said to the leaders in the church, wouldn't it be a good idea if we let the world know that this church is not only for the Tlingit people of Juneau? And they said, that's a good idea. And the word went out and other non-natives started to come. And the church was just growing.
Memorial Presbyterian became the first racially mixed congregation in town. Soboloff also had a radio ministry, both in English and Tlingit.
We had a half an hour, 11:30 to 12. The choir came on, and there was a short sermon, not that long, and then a closing hymn and benediction. I often felt people just don't like long sermons, and I made short ones. I cut the bologna in half.
After 22 years, Memorial Presbyterian was closed. Soboloff boarded the Presbyterian mission boats, the Princeton Hall and Anna Jackman, to take the gospel to remote southeast Alaska villages, logging camps, and Coast Guard lighthouses.
I'd go up to the dock with a pack sack on my back, Bibles, and I'd have visits with the Coast Guardsmen, 4 or 5 men, remote, every boat going by never stopped. We did. And the fellas liked it. I visited with them and had short devotions. And I gave a Bible to one fellow, and he said, now I have time to read the Bible. I gave him one, you know. Now I have time to read the Bible. I'll never forget that. Such good visits. Such good visits.
When he retired from full-time ministry, he taught the first Alaska Native Studies program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. While classes were small in those days, Professor Soboloff always had 50 to 60 students enrolled.
The biggest classes on the campus. It's what the youth wanted. What seems to draw them is to appreciate, to learn who they are. It seems to have a stabilizing effect.
Dr. Soboloff bridged more than a century of Alaska history and change that saw the integration of a society that once discriminated against his people. Many of his studies and papers documenting Alaska Native brother and sisterhoods and the Native land claim struggle have already been donated to Sea Alaska Heritage Foundation.
Part of Walter's legacy comes not just from how long he's been alive, but the different eras that he lived through.
The Reverend Dr. David Dobler is pastor of the Presbytery of Alaska, which serves Presbyterian churches in Southeast.
When I met him in the 80s, he was due to retire and was seemingly known and knew everybody in the state and beyond, and has this remarkable gift and attitude of holding, I think, every person as though they were in a state of grace. I've never heard him be angry with somebody.
Dr. Sobolov had a wonderful sense of humor and knew how to laugh. He often said his vision for longevity was simple.
Be living and enjoying and sharing, and I think that's how God made us, to be sharing the good that he has shared with you.
He outlived two wives. Genevieve and Walter had four children who live in Juneau. Genevieve died in 1986. When he was 90, he married Stella, who passed away in 2009. On his 100th birthday, Dr. Sobolov had this to say to the youth at the convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives.
I was in the first grade, and the teacher said, take care of the old person you're going to become. And I thought, what a funny talk to give us. But I never forgot it. It was one of the best messages I ever heard. Take care of the old person you're going to become. Here I am.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com. And by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska.
Alaskans sometimes like to boast that their state is twice the size of Texas. But surely Texas can always brag about their cowboy heritage. Well, at least for one day recently, some Kenai Peninsula residents got a taste of that as well. With what else but a cattle drive on horseback outside Soldotna, KDLL's Ben Stanton tried to follow along and capture the story of the 8-mile round trip.
Granted, it's on the outskirts of Soldotna off Kalifornsky Beach Road, and this is a rodeo grounds, but the event does still mean driving cattle through a neighborhood and, at one point, by a motorcycle rider training.
Kind of interesting to have a cattle drive go through your beginner motorcycle course, you know.
President of the Soldotna Equestrian Association, Chris Sorrells, is standing in a dusty trail at the equestrian arena where summertime competitions will start up soon. Rodeos need cattle to rope, drive into pens and whatnot, and in most years, cattle arrive by trailer. And some have this year also, but Sorrells got a call this year from the Diamond M Ranch, down the road a few miles along the Kenai River. They asked Sorrells' group if they might want to co-sponsor a cattle drive.
From Diamond M Ranch over here to the rodeo grounds. And of course, we were very interested.
Sorrells knew he would need some help, which meant Equestrian Association Vice President Mike Anderson.
I called him and asked him if he could ride the trail for us so we'd know what we were getting into.
Well, Anderson saddled his horse to ride it and decided against taking the highway with a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit.
We were able to move the route somewhat to make it a little more user-friendly.
Down a side road, past the Kenai Peninsula College, through a neighborhood, and along a pipeline right-of-way. My talk with Anderson and Sorrells is a little too quiet. How about some sounds of horses at the start of the trip? Jacob and Melissa Fowler are brother and sister, and the horses they are saddled in are related too.
Well, Boo, he's the dad, this is the mom, and this is their baby Rio. We kind of keep it all in the family. They're pretty good all-around horses. They do barrels, they chase cows.
Yeah, that's good, because they'll definitely be chasing cows today. But, Jacob, have you ever chased cows, driving them through an unfenced area?
No, just team penning and stuff.
Lonnie's from Nebraska. He's from Nebraska, so.
I'm originally from Nebraska. We do this stuff.
daily.
Next to the Fowlers, Lonnie Feller says there's a state of mind that's important once the cattle are rounded up.
Ride like you got an egg in the back of your pocket. That's pretty much what it is. The slower they go, the better off it is. If they get wild and they get rowdy and they get heated up and stuff, they don't tend to push very well. So.
Yeah.
And these cows aren't really used to people, let alone highways and roads and all this stuff that they don't necessarily get to see all the time.
Well, now is the slow start. A lot of cowboy hats are on a few dozen heads of people on the horses passing by me. It's a cloudy afternoon, little light drizzle occasionally. Things are still calm. The group makes it to the grazing area, gets the cattle, starts slowly bringing them back. You can hear one ATV that's riding along with the group, and coming back through the neighborhood, someone's dog is loose. Voices shout out, whistles ring out, the dogs bark, which apparently the cattle do not like. Several cows break away from the group and get off the road. And they're running through someone's yard. The organizers say they'd notified the neighborhood to be prepared, but things happen. Anderson says safety and respecting property are their top priorities. Well, the cattle are now convinced to get back in line, and they tromp down the road, where they await more excitement at the rodeo grounds. Meantime, Sorrels says feedback from youngsters show a longing for more experiences like this.
You just don't get anything more wholesome than coming down and playing at the rodeo grounds.
Yeah, well, wholesome is good and all that, but some young people might respond more to activities that use words like extreme.
We're telling them, look, you know, come down and play with us. That's rodeo is probably the original extreme sport.
Luckily, the cattle drive was not as extreme as it could have been. Not everyone here is an expert, but it was one experience of what might be more to come. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
Muscogee Creek Nation musician and author Joy Harjo is in Alaska as the artist-in-residence for Kuwanuk Broadcast Corporation in Anchorage. Kuwanuk is the parent company for station KNBA, and Harjo is spending time performing and traveling around the state. Although she says she was one of the shyest kids at Indian school in New Mexico, she overcame the discouragement of a music teacher who told her girls couldn't play the saxophone and a stepfather who forbid her from singing in the house to become one of the premier Native musicians, poets, and authors in the country. Her new CD, Red Dreams, A Trail Beyond Tears, is her fifth release.
Every album I've learned something on. The first album, Letter from the End of the 20th Century, which I did with my band Poetic Justice, has become a kind of classic. It's been called the best dub poetry album in America. But it was on that one I learned to play saxophone. I was basically learning to play sax. The second album, Native Joy for Real, I started singing on that one. The third one was a spoken word to go with a special release of She Had Some Horses. And then this album, I've learned to play Native flutes on it.
Are there favorites on this CD or songs? I'm sure all of them are your favorites, but are there some that stand out that you'd want to talk about?
Well, the Rainbow Gratitude is what, the only one with sax in it. It's got flutes, too, but it was written for a rainbow, a particular rainbow. All of those tunes are written in honor of somebody or for something. And Urban Crow Dance kind of gets, it's the last one and it leads, you know, it's very danceable. And the next album I do, I want to be very danceable. I love R&B and funk. That's some of my favorite music.
Osawa Crow Dance. Hop.
And some of that has spoken. There's a tribute to Wilma Mankiller, an honor song for her. I wrote that and performed that song to say that her life mattered. You know, she remains an inspiration, and it was one of those special people, or what the Cherokees call a beloved woman.
And now here you are in Alaska, in the Artist in Residence program for KMBA. What's the effort there? What's the idea to have you here for this month in Alaska? What will be happening?
I'm actually proposed a pilot of a show that's kind of inspired by this American life. I would like to do a national, this Native life show. With music, though, also with music, with songs as part of the, you know, I love Ira Glass, I love the format, and I love stories and storytelling, and I would like to do that for you, for, you know, the indigenous country, well, the Americas and Hawaii, and so I'm working on the pilot show of that.
Do you envision that you'll have a pilot by the time you leave?
I would like to. We'll see how much, you know, what I get done. I have other things I'm doing here, of course, and I'm performing at Alaska Native Heritage Center and doing other things. I'm trying to get out to St. Lawrence Island and to Nome, and I wanted to get up to Barrow. I'm not sure that's going to happen.
When you travel around Alaska and visit communities, what do you think about as far as how Alaska Native communities compare or are different from other Native communities in the lower 48?
Up here, I think it's, you know, the land is huge. The consciousness of the land is huge. You know, there's not a huge population of human beings or huge urban populations. But I think what's going for the people, you know, up here is just the massive and immense spirit of the land. It's like coming home in another, and I don't always understand, there's a mystery, you know, there's a lot of mystery in this world. But I always feel that when I come up here.
When they had the reception at KMBA for you, you read a poem about Anchorage. I was hoping to have you read part of that.
Anchorage. This city is made of stone, of blood, and fish. There are Chugach Mountains to the east and whale and seal to the west. It hasn't always been this way because glaciers who are ice ghosts create oceans, carve earth, and shape this city here by the sound. They swim backwards in time. Once a storm of boiling earth cracked open the streets, threw open the town. It's quiet now, but underneath the concrete is the cooking earth. And above that air, which is another ocean where spirits we can't see are dancing, joking, getting full on roasted caribou, and the praying goes on, extends out.
Kawanak Broadcast Corporation's artist-in-residence Joy Harjo, her poem Anchorage can be heard in its entirety at our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Susan Bucknell in Kotzebue, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau, and Ben Stanton in Soldotna. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering access to online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
How do you get men to wear their life jacket when the fact is that 90% of boating-related fatalities in Alaska are men? Well, truthfully, most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Get a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.